fantastic. We just want to make this as interactive as possible. This is about you guys. It's not about us. We really want to ensure that you guys spend a wonderful hour. So my name is Shane Shapiro. I am your moderator. I'm here as the executive director of a new NGO called the Center for Music Ecosystems. We work on data and research and evidence to explain why music matters around the world. And I also run a company called Sound Diplomacy. The reason that I put this panel together with these three incredible people is often when the whole topic of music cities. Are you all familiar with the topic of music cities and music policy? Who isn't? Because if you're not, I'll explain it. Okay, good. So music cities or music policy is when there is deliberate and intentional policy in city governments or state governments to help support the development of music in one way or another. So whether that's investing in music education or having live music policies that are supportive of music venues, or having the right tax breaks or incentives for music. Similarly, then most communities have for film, for example. There are lots of communities over the last 5 years, maybe 7 years, that have done this, that have taken deliberate and intentional steps within their city councils, state governments, regional governments, national governments, I know there's, that take music seriously, right? Rather than thinking of it as something that is bolted on, we think of it as something that's built in, right? You build it in rather than you bolt it on. Most of these policies and ideas come from the perspective of the music industry, right? What's best for us as the music industry? How can we ensure that we create a framework that works most for us? And sometimes we forget that music, you know, music is one of the only things that we don't need to live, but we can't live without. And when we think of the value of music in communities, what music does in communities, we can't just think about music in terms of how to specifically grow a music economy for musicians. That's one thing. But also, we need to look at music's holistic value on communities as an ecosystem. And I wanted to bring together three people who don't work in the music industry, technically, because you don't, but love music and are doing things in their communities that are just as impactful for the music economy and for their music ecosystems as anyone working in the music economy, to show that we should think in a different way about how we measure and understand what music ecosystems are, right? Why music matters to communities, why we need to invest in it, why we need to think of it, as we say, from nursery to nursing home, right? Why we need to really embed it in the strategic decisions that we all are a part of as decision makers or as voters in the communities that you all live in. And one of those is that we need a thriving, healthy music industry that supports musicians, that makes it, and that enables live music, that enables the industry to thrive, but it's about much more than that. It's about talent development. It's about where people want to live and why they want to live where they want to live. It's about creating the best kind of jobs and communities and transitioning away from, you know, polluting industries. And it's about making governments think differently about jobs and growth. So I just wanted to kind of introduce that. And again, thank you all for coming. That's the theme of this panel, is how we can think about music in a slightly different way. And hopefully you guys can kind of take away some ideas back to your communities. So first off, I'd just like the panelists to introduce themselves going from this way. So Tati.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here, and Shane for inviting us today. My name is Tatiana Orozco. I come from Barranquilla, Colombia. Barranquilla is known for having the fourth largest carnival in the world. And we are currently developing the largest entertainment district in Latin America. We analyzed like what was happening in Colombia in terms of there are no venues, music venues where you can have The largest, I think it's like 14,000 people. So tickets are very expensive if you want to bring a very good artist with a large audience. Then it was very uncomfortable to go to soccer games because the infrastructure wasn't the one that we expected to have. And stadiums were not having the impact in the community and in the areas that we wanted. So we started this project where we were going to have a 53,000 people arena with a hotel, a retail shopping center. We're going to be having restaurants and also residents. So we're very excited because of the impact that this will have, not only in our city, but also in the country, having a new venue for artists to present themselves. And I love music as well.
Thank you. And Jessica?
Hi, everyone. My name is Jessica Ball. I am the director of the Delaware Division of the Arts. It's the arts state, it's the state arts agency. For the last 5 years before that, I was running the Delaware Arts Alliance, which is the advocacy organization that advocates for music, art, culture, and the creative economy. And I just stepped into this new role inside of government back in December. So I'm a few months in now. So before it, I was advocating to policymakers, to the government officials about why music, art, and culture are so important. And now I'm on the inside funding music, arts, and culture in the state.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Webb, founder and CEO of App Harvest. We're in central Appalachia in Kentucky, in the middle part of the U.S. Why I'm here is because of Shane. Our company has nothing to do specifically with music, but we, as a company that is growing fast in the middle part of the U.S., we realize as we grow, the communities around us and their vibrancy are vital in being able to attract and retain talent. Our company was up for an innovation award here at South By. We lost, but no. In the new economy category, we grow fruits and vegetables indoors using technology. But we realized that, you know, what is the responsibility of a company in 2022? It's far greater than just returning capital to investors. And our responsibility is really to the communities that we operate in, the communities we serve. And we realize that, you know, every great company being built in 2022 and beyond needs to be focused on what they're doing in the creative arts economy to help support that and grow that. You look at Austin. Austin doesn't exist without its creative community. You probably don't have half the tech companies here that would have located here without it. And so I think for us, we've worked with Shane and our governor in Kentucky to try to think through how do we create policy that better holistically looks at the value around creative arts and what does that mean? And for us, I think being a large employer in the region and a new company that is attracting talent to the region, you know, trying to use the weight that we have to be able to work with policymakers that, frankly, are very narrow-minded on how they look at creative. And Shane, look forward to continuing the discussion here, but how we better use policy to create those creative centers that are going to be a force for good in communities.
Great. Well, thank you, guys. So we don't have to talk for a half an hour and then open it up to questions. We can be more relaxed about that. So if anyone has a question or a comment or you want to tell a story from wherever you guys are, please just put your hand up and I'll interrupt these fine people and hand the floor over to you guys. Again, this is try to make this as much a conversation between all of us rather than a conversation just between the four of us. So I have some questions, and we're going to try to have a really interesting discussion over the next half hour or so. But I'm going to start, you know, with you, Taddy. How many people in here have heard of Barranquilla? 4.
Okay, so that's not 50%.
Okay, so, you know, so first off, how did you, you know, walk me through the story of you know, going into the city and convincing them that this, leading with music and culture, but having everything else around, was the right way to go. Like, you know, this is a very, very, very large, expensive project, the biggest in the region.
Mm-hmm.
So walk me through, you know, how you first off convinced local governments and how music played a role in that.
So the first thing is that we are not asking for any government money for the project. So it's $500 million U.S. Dollars investment, all privately funded. So that's the first thing. But we do need it, the city. We do need it, the city. We do need the city. Because as I always say, I'm an economist myself, and I said if this was all about bricks, they would have hired civil engineer or something like that to be leading the project. It's all about creating the right ecosystem for Arena del Rio to develop in the city and to have the right impact. So the first thing that we did is the first thing that I want to highlight is that we have a government that is very proactive in terms of bringing investment to the city and in terms of working together with the private government towards new developments. So we both had conversations both with the national government, with President Iván Duque, with the mayor of Barranquilla, Jaime Pumarejo, and we told them, listen, this is what we want to do, and this is the impact that we want to have. And I do believe, I mean, because they're very pro-business, they were open to talk to us about that. But then also, another thing that highlights the fact that we can have this in Barranquilla is that Barranquilla is the home for the national soccer team. Like all the elimination, like all the pre-Qatar games or pre-soccer world games are held in Barranquilla. So the city already knows the impact of events like whenever there's a World Cup eliminatory, then we have like maybe 50,000 people coming into the city. So having had that was key in terms of the city understanding the impact in terms of job creation, economy growth that these type of events have. So imagine having 80 events a year. So that's, I think, how we address the conversation and the number of, both direct and indirect jobs that we would have. And, you know, they were very open, and I do have to say that they gave us a whole team dedicated to bringing all the city permits that we need very quickly. So we've been very blessed with having, you know, all their support, even though we're not asking for a penny, we're asking for their collaboration.
Yeah, and, you know, how Barranquilla is, what, 300,000 people?
No, 12. It's 1,200,000 people.
Much bigger. Sorry, yeah. I should know that.
And the state is 2 million.
So it's a big city.
It's the fourth largest city. I'm sure you haven't heard about Barranquilla, the ones that said, but you do know Shakira. She's from there. Sofia Vergara. So those are, and...
Oh, Shakira's from there?
Shakira's from there, yeah.
Come on. All right. Well, you should lead with that.
So, Colombia is a country that has more than 1,000 types of folk music.
Yeah.
So it's very important for us, the tradition that we have in terms of, and now you probably know, of course, J Balvin. Sebastian Yatra is presenting himself here on Saturday night. So if you're here, you better watch him. And there's a huge culture around music. And again, I told you, we have the fourth largest carnival. So that also brings about the impact that, you know, events such as this have in the community.
Do you have Shakira involved with this project at all?
No.
See, that's...
I'll tell you why.
That's a problem. And that, it just generally speaking, these artists that, you know, continue to make names for themselves and, you know, the community, we in Kentucky have several artists that are at the top of the country charts. And I was mentioning earlier, moved to Nashville. So Chris Stapleton, Sturgill Simpson, I don't know if you all listen to them, but chart toppers in the country music field, you know, working with their management team, working with them to, you know, the value creation for those artists on being able to be influential in their communities and stand for something other than, you know, just writing a good lyric or a dance song, it's critical. But I would say, as an outside observer that has no idea about this project, but builds big stuff, we build a lot of stuff, and where we're at, what a shame that you have your biggest cultural icon of the city that's not even involved with the biggest project in the city. And, like, that's a miss, and it's happening all... So, Shane, my thing would be, it's happening all around the U.S., all around the world every day, and how do you get these cultural icons that just can shift and morph and move conversations so quickly? How do you get them tethered in? And the question would be, why would Shakira not be involved with this project?
To be quite honest, at first what we thought it's, we have backing our project, this Universal Music Group with EU Music Hotels, so we're bringing them in, and she's a Sony artist. Yeah. So, you know, that you know, was part of the conversation. But talking about iconic people, we do have involved one of our partners in the project is Major League Baseball player Edgar Renteria, who came back to the city and he said, "I want to do this," and it's both a sports and music venue.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting question, and I think it comes back. And again, we're looking at measuring impact and in music ecosystems. And one of the things that is very interesting around this is how we define place and how place matters and what place is when an artist start somewhere and then they move to the larger city and then leave. How can we create a different definition? And kind of going back to you, Jonathan, I know you don't work in the music industry, but I know you love music and you're engaged in music. How can, you know, tell me, like, why you have looked at culture, arts and culture in Moorhead, Kentucky, which is, I would say, the opposite of Barranquilla. It's a town of 8,000 people, 10,000 people, versus a city of 1.2 million. And, you know, I'd like you to tell me a little bit more about kind of the journey of App Harvest and how you have kind of embedded your thinking around arts and culture into the wider, you know, the wider thinking of how to improve the place, right?
Yeah, so we as a company just went public on the NASDAQ last year, building stuff to grow fruits and vegetables using technology. So you would think, why in the world are we so heavily engaged on arts and music and culture? And again, it goes back to, you know, look at Austin. Like, why is Austin so vibrant? And it's because of that music and art scene that's been here. And I think for everybody, whether you're in Columbia or in Brooklyn or Detroit, or you're in a rural part of the U.S., you know, pushing on our city councils, pushing on our mayors, pushing on our representatives of those states to understand how important music is to the vibrancy of that city. It unquestionably is one of the largest pieces that attracts people to a city. So, you know, you look at Atlanta or you look at Miami, you look at, you know, any vibrant city in the U.S. right now. And those companies are co-locating there because those employees that want to work at those vibrant companies want to make sure that they can go out at night. And, you know, I think our state has, we've missed on a lot of that. We've had a lot of people go to Nashville, but we have one in Louisville, Jack Harlow, that has done a great job of trying to carry the city on his back. But, like, any community anywhere needs to be looking at those musicians as representatives of that city, and that if they succeed, the chances of that city being able to land a company who's going to employ, you look at us, we'll have about 1,500 employees at the end of the year. You know, we've been pushing our governor to say, you don't get it when it comes to attracting a company. You really need to be, you know, supporting the musicians in these communities across our state, because when they succeed, those cities rise up in many different ways. And I know, Shane, you do your reports and the analysis, and it's really hard to quantify what it means to have a vibrant, healthy music and arts scene. And I know that's obviously what your work is in Delaware, but I think we're just kind of, I know that conversation has been going on for decades, but I hope, you know, it's more broad now that, you know, we really start having it in every city. that, you know, we need to ensure that these musical assets that are being created are really being quantified for what they are, and it's much more than just a hit song or a hit album. It's a cultural movement that can ignite a city or a region, and I think it's, you know, definitely overlooked, and we you know, we're looking at our specific lane, which is rural part of Kentucky, and you know, we've lost a lot of great, incredible talent that has gone to Nashville, and we're trying to figure out how to get them back and be a part of reinvigorating communities where we're at. But it doesn't matter where you are, it's, the story's kind of the same over and over again.
Yeah, and it's interesting how COVID, in essence, was a case study in how music matters. Like, you know, imagine all of us being locked in our houses without music. That would have sucked. And I know it still sucked, being locked in our houses, but think about it. And the investment in music has not increased. Structural investment in music has not increased post-COVID. There's definitely been some relief money. And kind of directing that question that Jonathan just asked on you, Jessica, you are government now, so we can just pick on you as government. But no, it's, I know that you have a lot of colleagues that may not get it when you're talking about how to measure impact, when you're talking about explaining why music, arts, and culture matter compared to attracting a factory that, you know, makes something that you can touch rather than makes something that you can feel. And so, you know, armed with many years as a advocate and lobbyist, essentially, for arts and culture, what are your arguments? How are you going to your senators and your bosses and saying, listen, you need to put money into this?
Well, before I answer that question, I do want to say that I think there has been a shift over the last decade in policymakers and folks in government understanding music, art, and culture as and the creative economy as an industry that is important and needs to be invested in. And I think the proof of that is that in 2008, 2009, when the Great Recession hit, the creative economy didn't get any sort of relief or rebuilding money from the federal government, from state governments. And as we moved through the pandemic, I think we saw at the federal level, state and municipal level, governments saying we need to rescue this sector, this industry from the economic fallout of the pandemic. So we had Save Our Stages and the Shuttered Venues Operators Grant, the National Endowment for the Arts got money that went to states, and many states, in fact, close to 30 states created specific COVID arts and culture grant programs to get money out to artists and to venues. So I think there's a big shift from the recession to the economic fallout of COVID that is heartening for me to see that government officials are starting to take the creative economy seriously as an industry. So that. But there's still work to be done. There's still a long way to go. And I think the unique thing about music and arts in general is that I think it's easy to measure the economic impact of music and art on a city, and depending on who you're talking to in government, that may be a really important data set for them. But beyond the economic impact, I think those of us that work in the creative economy understand that there's a huge social and cultural impact that our industry brings to cities and states. And so I think that we're starting to explore those connections more when we're trying to do our case making. It's not just about investing money into the arts and music to get an ROI of more money, but there's a reason to invest in it because you're going to have a population that's more connected. You're going to have a population that's more civically engaged. You know, music and art can be used to mitigate lots of issues that governments deal with, like crime, violence, education, health, community health. And so starting to think beyond the dollars and cents when we are talking about the value of music and culture is, I think, the next step that we're really starting to take in our case making.
Yeah, it moves very slowly.
It does.
As I'm learning, there's a lot of assumptions. I think we all know music. Everyone believes music's a good thing. I'm sure everyone in here, right? Music is generally a good thing, right? Music education is generally a good thing. I think we all agree on that.
Yes.
Yet music education funding has not increased.
And also that just the systems haven't evolved at all. Not at all. That's not the right word. Haven't evolved progressively enough. I mean, you look at there's startup incubators in every city. So, you know, if I had a startup, you would have, you know, co-working spaces, you know, many a times funded through city governments because they realize one of the great economic engines, the largest employer in the U.S. is through startups. It's the largest growth of new jobs is through startups, not through big corporations. That it's what is the next big corporation, and that will look at Austin. There, you know, would it be the same without Dell? No, it wouldn't be. So, you know, Dell locating here and that arts thrive, but why aren't there incubators for artists to, you know, with people developing NFTs or, you know, new business models for how to distribute songs and artists that, you know, want to record and filmmakers? This is it really, when you look at how much money our government blows, it's incredibly low cost to incubate this inside of cities all across the U.S., giving those artists the opportunity to go create with other co-creators, and the ripple effect out of that would be enormous. But yet our arts and cultural funding, not only in schools, which is just continues to flatline, but the innovative models around how we could do this better hasn't evolved at all with the times. And it's disheartening at least, and depressing at most, and, you know, but goes back to that isolated concentration of where artists end up going, where you got LA or Atlanta or, you know, Austin or Nashville, instead of decentralized all across communities, all across the U.S. And unfortunately, lack of leadership maybe, but, you know, I think with people like you and Shane, obviously your work, that it really is just a vision. It's not even about the money, really. It's more about just the vision of what's possible and trying to get cities to take this on. But why, Shane? Why isn't it moving?
I think it's moving. I think we just want it to move faster.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's deep in our hearts. No, I mean, we just, and Barranquilla, the mayor just opened a factory called the Culture Factory. And it's basically for music education and arts and culture. But I do have to say that, you know, sometimes you impact indirectly education, because I have to say there was this thing that happened to me right after we announced that in El Rio, I went to the bank. And I've been a very public person in my city because I used to work for the government and had this good positions in government. So people kind of know me. And I went to the bank, and this guy who is just handling like turns in the bank, just giving me the number in the bank, tells me, "So, Tatiana, how's the project going?" And I said, "Okay, very good. We just started, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "You know, ever since they announced Arena El Rio in Barranquilla, I've been thinking of doing a master's degree in music production." So, it you know, that fact of having that conversation with the guy in the bank saying, you know, I have new things that I'm thinking about just because of this project, you know, it inspires.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I learned in the 70s in the U.S. that there was a class that all fourth graders took called Music Appreciation. It got phased out from 1976, I believe. But it was just kind of general basic introduction to music education and music theory and music appreciation. Like, and it was a standard thing, and it got phased out along with other arts and culture education. And I agree. I think that, you know, going back is how, you know, how are we measuring the impact in whatever language that people need to understand, right? And that's what I struggle with. And I'm curious as well with you guys. Like, if you're still with us, are you still with us? All right, that's good. I have to ask. Please, you know, if you if you have a story, you have something from your community, I know there are a couple people in here who probably do, please, I think there's a mic in the middle there. That's our friend Steven. You can, he's a bit late, so we can give him a round of applause. But I think that that's what I, Jonathan, that's my challenge, and why I wanted to, you know, why I like having these conversations is I can say how much music, arts and culture, is worth economically. That's not hard. Like, you ask people, there are statistical models, and you can also do the social and cultural impact.
But see, even shockingly, it just broadly speaking, and we obviously are spending a lot of time with policymakers from the governor down in our state, and I know to you the economic benefits are obvious, but to many and most, they're not. And it's, you know, not widely apparent that you're right. So there's step one, which is the economic benefits of having a thriving music and arts scene. But even that is not, you know, why it's like we took your report. So we commissioned a report with Shane and took it to governor and cabinet secretaries in the state, and no one really realized it. And so that was that. That's number one.
Yeah.
And I I'm curious with Delaware. I mean, what we in Kentucky are nearly last on the list. So you said it, Shane, we're like 50 or 48 out of state. So we have a lot of room to improve.
Lower 40s.
Lower 40s. How quickly is this moving in the U.S., whether it's states or cities? I mean, how much are people?
I think when it comes to the U.S., it's interesting. It moves quicker in different countries, obviously. Like, Colombia has a long history of investing in music in so many different ways. I think in the U.S., you're right that a lot of money went to through the American Rescue Plan and CARES money to music, arts, and culture that didn't go in the recession. But there's only really, genuinely, one state that has a music office. Mm-hmm. Does anyone know what that state is? We are in it. Yeah. But there are offices of film and music. There are variations on a theme. But Texas is the only one that has a literal office of music in the office of the governor. And I have tried to create music offices in lots of states. And I think I'll get there. But you're right. I think that there's a difference between, which is what we're trying to solve, right? There's a difference between appreciating, understanding, and then acting on that understanding. And I think when you have a brewery in town that has gigs, like in Moorhead, there's a very good brewery in the center of town. I know they sometimes do live music. Once something appears in a community and is interesting, then we kind of forget how it came to be. And I don't have the full answer to that question, but I think that we are moving in the right direction. But let's hand it off to the audience for a question or a comment. And please introduce yourself.
Sure. Good afternoon, folks. My name is Melissa, and I am from Trinidad and Tobago. Like Jessica, I am the head of our music office in the government, which is called Music TT, Trinidad and Tobago Music Company Limited. And we have other arms as well. So we have Film TT and Fashion TT, which is self-explanatory. They say about their sectors. So I'm sitting there, and all I'm doing is this. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. So to start off, I guess, with Tatiana's comment, in that Trinidad and Tobago has the largest carnival in the Caribbean, right? And you would think, because our government knows the benefits that that entertainment sector brings to us, that they would support music cities and that they would help our music office a little bit better. They don't. We struggle, we fight. And it's weird because they created the arm, but they don't support it in the way that they should, especially financially. So to put context to that, our budget that we submit to them for a year is close to probably $100 million TT dollars. So divide that by 7, that'll give you the US figure. But we get $1.5 million TT dollars. So that doesn't, you know, even begin to equate with what we can do. So I'm a little bit curious in terms of Tatiana's side of things, how you got the private sector what sort of conversations or, I guess, presentations would have been had with them to sort of invest in that way. Because our private sector, when it comes to entertainment and culture, they literally only invest in glam. So like an event by South by Southwest that will give their name, you know, all over the place, you know, party hearty here and there. That is what they would invest in. But things that are structurally, economically beneficial to the society like that, they won't. So it's a bit of a struggle there with them.
It's still hard, I do have to say. I mean, the investors that we got for the project, they're all foreign investors. So they are some of them are Colombian nationals living abroad, right, but they all live abroad. And it's hard to convince sometimes the people, you know, that are locally. They don't understand the whole deal of where the benefit comes. But I think it's growing, and the carnival itself needs a lot of funding in Barranquilla, and it's every year they struggle as well to get all the funding from the private sector and the public as well. So it's still hard.
Understood. And I guess to Jonathan's comment, it's not a question, but just chiming in a little bit more on your comments about Shakira and these cultural icons, I agree with you. That is a pain point for us because we ourselves have a lot of major cultural icons within the Caribbean space and even within Trinidad and Tobago. And to get them to actually come back and do something for the sector is like pulling hairs. It is the worst experience ever. So I don't know. Hopefully somewhere in the future, they'll decide that, you know, it's worth jumping on the train for. So, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you. It's also the global nature of this conversation is very exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, I can represent London. It's where I live. So, please, and introduce
Hi.
Yourselves.
How you doing? Diego.
Do we need the microphone?
You don't know?
Yes, no. Yes.
We do? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, or because you're because it's being recorded. We're all being recorded.
Right. So, thank you. I was most intrigued by the comment from Jonathan, if you don't mind, about the... Diego, I work in an advertising agency. So I'm looking at this into what are the opportunities for us to invest with our brands. A lot of conversation, I think, on we all love music. Yes, we all love music. There are festivals. Yes, we can invest in festivals. But I like the comment of all the infrastructure that exists for startups, like co-working space. And there's not enough of that infrastructure for arts. Although some in the United States, you have some, and I think Chicago public libraries that have studios that artists can use, and there's been some movements. I'm originally from Argentina, at least in Argentina, where you know that can happen. But do you have examples where an approach like that has been implemented? Are there initiatives like that we could go and try to identify? It seems to me that that's an sort of like an interesting
space. There are a number of areas. One of the more successful ones in the U.S. is in Fort Collins, Colorado. Has anyone been there? It's called the Music District. Okay, it's an actual literal district of the town. It is privately funded for the most part. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's privately funded by a private foundation there. But it's 4 or 5 square blocks. And all the buildings are dedicated in one way or another to music and art. So production of music, dissemination, arts and culture, I mean, production, dissemination, and so on. There are loads, you know, there's one in Chicago called 2112, which is one of the biggest, I think, in America. It's really big, which is the wider creative economy. And that, you know, I think it's an interesting thing. Language is really important, and one thing that I've learned is if you don't call it a music venue, you call it an incubator or an accelerator, right? And every band every artist is a startup, because every artist is a startup, in essence.
And that, for some reason, gets, you know, the respect of regulators, policymakers, mayors more often, and, you know, kind of reframing the discussion and the nuance of the language. But, you know, it's unfortunate. You even have, again, I'll continue to harp on the place I'm from, but Kentucky, you know, my nephew moved to L.A. because he didn't see a place that was able to support his creative, you know, means. And similarly, people moved to Nashville. But this really isn't that difficult. We're just trying, from a cost standpoint, again, fairly low cost investment, but from a sponsor standpoint, it could even be, you know, brought to you by Red Bull or whatever, but just places that are funky and vibrant and you know, leaning forward just with tools and spaces, could be garages, buildings, but, you know, this wouldn't take that much. And unfortunately in the U.S., we have rundown buildings all across our urban centers, so there's plenty of vacant space, and it just takes a little bit of vision and connection to back to like, for our startup, the concept with us, we're in the middle of the U.S. 80% of venture capital goes to New York City, Boston, and San Francisco. So 80% of all the venture capital and startups goes to three cities. And for us, we wanted to build in the middle of the U.S. and tap that innovation of people there. But decentralizing these pieces of the economy, and the arts hasn't done it, I don't think, as well as what startups are doing now. You look at Austin. So Austin's an example of that decentralization, people moving from San Francisco to here, and you've got now all these startup hubs across the U.S. from Chattanooga, Tennessee, to Tampa, to Detroit, to Brooklyn. How can, you know, and maybe it even goes above, it could be a federal thing, Shane, from the federal government down, and in reframing, you know, how do we take spaces and communities all across the U.S., and just light them up with vibrancy to retain that talent? Because the thing we hear time and again in the startup world, a lot of kids want to live where they grew up. They don't want to move to Boston. They move to Boston because they need to get a job there. Or they move to LA because that's where you go to be creative. Or you move to Nashville because that's where you go to be creative. So how we have schools all across the U.S. that have these wonderful minds, but we don't have the tools that once, you know, they reach middle life are able to tap that talent. And it just seems like a big missed opportunity that the playbook of startups with these incubators and collaboration spaces just doesn't seem like it's there for the creative arts and economy. And it, you know, seems like a gap that, you know, you could take the playbook of startups and kind of roll it out for the creative economy, but it's not really happening.
I think Shane needs to tell us about what he's doing now.
This is about you guys.
Thank you.
But it's very interesting.
Thank you.
No, I think going back, it's you know, you're right. That language is important. That's one thing that I have learned. And also, Jessica, I think I have learned that if you say the right words, I'm not American. I'm Canadian, and I live in the UK. So I have had to learn the language of American business as a non-American. And I've also been to more of this country than most Americans because of my, been all 48 states in the mainland now. I've been to, as I said, I've been to Tulsa four times. Who's been to Tulsa four times? Tulsa's great, so recommend it. But I learned that the concept of workforce development, which is what I know you do, your greenhouses create workforce, is something that is lost on someone whose only experience in music is recreationally, right? And we all tend to forget them when all of us are having fun, someone's got to work to create that fun. And I always liken it to the glass of water analogy. When we all drink a glass of water, right, we completely forget what went into this moment happening, all the filtration and all the pipes and the plumbing and so on. And clean water is only important when you don't have it. And this is the same thing that goes through our mind when we listen to a song or we're at a gig. Completely forget everything that went into that moment happening and the infrastructure required to create those moments. So I think that, I also feel, I think positively, like you do, Jesse, I feel like we're moving in the right direction. But the infrastructure conversation, literal infrastructure, whether it is a building or somewhere in the metaverse that is needed for music to thrive in whatever way, is a very, very new conversation. Whereas the startup conversation is 20, 30 years old, right? So, you know, I do believe that we're getting there, but we are not singing from the same hymn sheet because we haven't written the hymn sheet. And that's what I'm trying to do, is I try to write this hymn sheet for all of us to sing off of, to try to be a translator to explain why music matters. And that's what the Center for Music Ecosystems is trying to do. But I, and also the, you know, the and Jessica, I want to bring you in on this, is there is a lot of investment in Delaware, mm-hmm. historically, or everywhere. Delaware, I know, tiny little state, but there is a lot of investment for workforce development, right? And to attract companies. There's, pardon my French, there's a shitload of opportunity zones.
There are. There's
an opportunity zone, does everyone know what that is in the United States? It was, a few said no, so if you don't know, it was a Trump era law, right, that provides tax breaks to invest in certain areas of a community. And you can kind of build anything. Mm-hmm. Very, very, Delaware, the whole state is essentially an opportunity zone, as I've now learned. So is that the problem in Delaware? Because there's loads of money for workforce development.
Well, right? There is.
And is that where we need to move towards?
There is money for workforce development, and I think you've all sort of brought up this point about language and words that matter and trying to get decision makers to understand. And I think part of that means that we in the creative sector have to understand what decision makers value and understand how to talk to them in a way that they understand. Nobody cares about your thing except for you. Nobody. Your thing is so important. You're so passionate about it. Nobody cares about it. They only care about it if you can frame it in a way that aligns with their values and puts it in parallel with something that they're very passionate about. And so I've run up against this problem in Delaware where I haven't been able to get very much ARP money invested in the arts and culture and music industry. And so my governor's obsessed with workforce development. So I've spent the last couple of weeks designing out a creative workforce development grant program. And I'm going to present that to him, and I've already got buy-in from a couple of people because you're speaking the governor's language now, and you're framing it in a way that he can understand. And I think that's the beauty of our industry, is that there is music for music's sake, there is art for art's sake, and that's important in and of itself, but we impact so many other sectors and so many other facets of life that we have a lot of great stories to tell, and we can work with people in communities, we can work with advocates, community advocates, and do grassroots advocacy so that the decision makers understand that communities want creative interventions to make a difference in their life and in their communities. So I think it's about framing things in a way that people can understand and care about. So if all you care about is workforce development, fine, let's talk about workforce development for creatives and let's build out a program around that. And that's gonna be my strategy working inside of government, is how can I figure out what everybody cares about and then get resources for the creative economy based on what their interests and what their priorities are.
Yeah, I've learned that it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't really matter what I think or like. It's true. And I think that that's something that we as a music economy, music lovers, music business, creative, whoever you guys are, advertising agency, I think that we have to be better at understanding what other people want. And, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, I think, you know, Kentucky, there's lots of people in Kentucky that love music and culture. This is a state built on sport and booze, right? As well as coal. But like horse racing and bourbon, loads of money goes into those two things. And I would argue that music has just as much a history in Kentucky than, so is that the question? Is that the issue, Jonathan, you think? We have to be better storytellers? Our narrative has to change?
Well, just again, the small successes we've had is, you know, that tether, and I think every politician in every state in the U.S. or every mayor wants one thing. They want to be reelected. So how do you get reelected? Well, typically when people have jobs and they're happy, you have happy voters. So, you know, the economic benefit should be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of the conversation, and then whatever else is just something else beyond that. But, you know, I think the gap that we've seen from just casual outsiders is that we haven't done a great job of saying that, you know, the creative minds that want to work at creative companies, that want to build and grow economies, are the same people that consume music and arts. And that needs to be, the community has to have that. Or our governor's done a great job of, probably somebody will send him a clip of this later and I'll get a phone call next week, but because maybe I've been a little too hard on it, but we just haven't done, I don't think we've directly correlated. You know, look again, Austin is a model, and if we dissect Austin, how did it end up the way it ended up? You know, Tesla now moving their headquarters here, that wouldn't be the case if this place wasn't thriving with the creative arts scene that it has. So, you know, again, with the policymakers we meet with, it's just how do we make that more a part of the discussion so that it's just common sense that you don't have thriving economies without thriving creative economies. And for some reason, there just doesn't seem to be a tether between the two that you know, that should be common sense.
But it's not only public sector. I believe we need to identify like all the stakeholders involved and then talk to them regarding, I mean, the music industry itself. You mentioned, you know, these big artists. When you talk to small ones, they're also, you know, they're also worried about what's happening in their communities regarding this. And sometimes they're the most critical people of all when you want to do something. So it's a matter of understanding, I mean, where all the different stakeholders hold.
It's true. The music industry is, not blameless. please.
Hi. So I'm Lucy. And I'm in high school still, so I'm not, like, actually in industry, but it's something that I want to do. But, earlier you were talking about, like, music education in schools, and I'm in my high school's band program, and, like, every year we have to do, like, massive fundraising to raise, like, thousands of dollars to, like, have enough money to, like, put on our, like, shows and stuff. And so, like, even though, like, I live here in Austin, and, like, as a place with, like, a thriving music scene and stuff, like, you would think that, like, we as a city would, like, be more proactive with, like, putting money into things like the school's, like, band and music programs. And I think it's a lot of, like, our tax money that we, like, pay gets, like, put into, like, other schools, and, like, not that some of those schools don't need it, but, like, we, like, AISD is, like, very much in debt, and I think that's why we don't get a lot of that money. So I think it's, like, commenting on, like, all your, like, government policy stuff, like, just, like, changing how our, like, recapture program is, like, being done probably would, like, I guess, give more money into those programs for music and culture and art. Yeah, I don't know.
No, but thank you for being here. First off, we really appreciate it. And yeah, I think music, one of the things, you know, music, over time, music became an elective, essentially, mm-hmm. right? It didn't used to be this way. I was forced to do music programs when I was a kid, and I actually hated it because I'm a terrible musician. But and I grew to like it. But And we moved from, you know, STEAM to STEM, right? And that, when you make something optional, you have, I believe, you create this belief in your mind that this is a nice to have, not a need to have. Mm-hmm. Math is a need to have, even though music is math. But moving on. And I think that gets disassociated from a thriving live music scene. Austin can have a thriving live music scene, and you can still be forced to fundraise for your band. And they're kind of not seen because we, this is the idea, is we need to think of it more as an ecosystem. And we need to look that, yes, a thriving live music scene would be even more, would be even stronger if each band was properly resourced as well. And I think that's the story that we have to continue to try to tell, right? And if you need to talk to your principal and talk to your teachers and tell them that this matters.
Mobilize your band and then have them mobilize other bands at other schools. Your voice matters, and the fact that you even had the courage to stand up and speak is the most important thing. So mobilize. I mean, that's the number one way to get people's attention at a local level on policy. And all your parents, get all your parents. I'm sure, you know, you get them, you get other schools, you get other bands, and you'll likely see change. But you've got to, you know, it's a groundswell up, but your voice matters.
Thank you.
I'll just add to that a little bit. I think it's tough with school because, you know, as Shane said, we moved from STEAM to STEM, and the arts stopped seeming to be a viable career to a lot of people, and we took out of schools any clear career pathways into music, into the creative economy. You know, it's like a cliche for someone to say to their parents, I want to be a musician, and for them to say, no, you have to get a real job. I want to be an artist. No, you have to get a real job. And I think something we're trying to do in Delaware is work with our Department of Education and a couple of our local state universities to turn art and music education into a CTE, so like a vocational type of career pathway that people can start taking while they're in school and have a clear direction into one of the state universities and then have a path into a career in the industry. So I think if we can start to build those connections again and build those pathways again, the rest of society will start to see the arts and music as a viable profession to go into. And so that's something we're trying to do in Delaware, and I hope other places start doing that too.
Yeah, it's interesting that all of us have the 93 million songs in our pocket right now, right, in our phones, and how that, again, disassociates the process of how this got to be the way it is. But I'm just noticing the time, you know, to close out, you know, we wanted to have a different conversation about music. I know there are lots of conversations happening at South By, but we wanted to kind of look at the role that music plays, you know, in our wider communities, and have voices that aren't directly in the music industry, but influencing it. So does anyone else have any? We've got time for one more final comment or question. Please don't be shy. You don't have to. We can have this awkward silence instead if you want. Okay? No?
Someone can sing.
No, I'm not going to make anyone sing. I sometimes make people sing to prove that music matters, but I think you guys know that. So on that note, it's 5 o'clock. So thank you guys so much for joining us. We really hope you enjoyed this conversation and you know, just wanted to be relaxed and informal and have a great rest of South By.
Thank you.
Thank you.